Who are the Valar? They get mentioned a lot in Tolkien's Legendarium and are clearly important, but who are they, actually? And what role do they play? Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. On this channel, we dive deep into the Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's wider Legendarium, as well as A Song of Ice and Fire and The Witcher. Welcome. To understand the Valar, we need to go right back to the beginning, before Tolkien's universe was even created. And as is typical for Tolkien, we get into the theology pretty quickly. The first sentence of the first chapter of the Silmarillion deals with Uru, Ilúvatar, the one god of Tolkien's Legendarium. We're told that he made first the Ainur, the holy ones that were the offspring of his thought, each of which comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came. Uru conducted them into the creation of beautiful music and song according to the themes he laid out. Melkor, one of the Ainur, kind of disrupted all of this with some discordant notes, but we'll look at that another time. As far as what we're looking at today is concerned, the important point is that after this music, Uru showed the Ainur the creation of their music, Arda, the world, and many of them wanted to go down to it. We read then that this condition Ilúvatar made, or it is the necessity of their love, that their power should thenceforward be contained and bounded in the world, to be within it for ever, until it is complete, so that they are its life and it is theirs. And therefore they are named the Valar, the powers of the world. So, at a high level, the Valar are expressions of Uru's thought, bound to the world until the end of time, authorised by Ilúvatar himself to shape and rule it. It's worth noting that although Ilúvatar showed them much of creation, he did not show them all of it, to the ends of time, and when they arrived in Arda, they arrived at the very beginning of its time, so they had to make happen what they had already sung and seen. Which means that they know some of what will happen, but not all. And they know some of Uru's thoughts and plans, but again, not all. Tolkien often refers to them as the gods of Middle-earth, and links to Norse or Greek godly pantheons, say, are easy to come by. But technically, they are not gods, rather the regents to Uru, ruling in his place. They should not therefore be worshipped, but honoured. And they were not to control or force the peoples of Middle-earth, but guide them and support them. Which isn't to diminish their power. They are very powerful. They just mostly hold it in check. The Valar are eternal and spiritual beings. They don't have to take specific physical forms, though they can and often do, appearing as humans, elves, or any other shape they want, usually connected with whichever part of Uru's thought they themselves manifest. For example, Yavanna, the giver of fruits associated with growing things, sometimes appeared as a tree. And as we'll see, each Valar had powers over the area they knew Uru's mind in. Using Yavanna again as an example, she had the power to make things grow, spreading vegetation across Middle-earth and the like. Thus, they shaped and ruled Arda, each seeing to their allotted roles. In this, they were assisted by Maiar. These were lesser Ainur, who had also been there in the beginning and descended to the world to help out. There were lots of these, many of which never took physical shape and, as far as we're concerned, remained nameless. They each seemed to serve one or more of the Valar specifically, rather than being a shared resource, and so gained specialist skills and interests. Radagast, for example, was a Maiar who served Yavanna. So, yeah, he liked nature and growing things. Okay, so that's a quick overview of what they are, but who are they? We're told that there are 14 of them, 8 greater and 6 lesser. Let's first look at the 8 greater Valar. The king of the Valar and the king of Arda is Manwë. He is greatest in authority, though not in power, and closest to the mind of Uru. He is associated with the wind and air and all birds. Most notably here, the great eagles, who appear wonderfully in time, seemingly all of the time in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, are his. So perhaps their appearances aren't quite so unexpected after all. Manwë is far-sighted and good, and the eagles are his messengers. Anyway, Manwë spends most of his time atop Tanaquetil, the tallest mountain in the world, with Varda, his wife, the second of the Valar. Varda is the queen of the Valar, and the queen of light and stars, the Valar most beloved by the elves, as the first thing they saw when they first awoke were the stars. She also made the lamps which lit the world in its earliest days, and set the sun and the moon on their courses. She is perhaps the most holy of the Valar, called Elbereth by the elves, and even the mention of her name is said to cause evil spirits to flee. Frodo calls on Elbereth on Weathertop, for example, and Tolkien tells us that it was a cause of terror to the Nazgul. Next, we have Ulmo, the Lord of Waters, and Manwë's closest ally beside his wife. It is said that Eru taught him more of the music than any other, and that he, with Manwë, most faithfully served the wishes of Ilúvatar. Ulmo is different to the rest of the Valar, though, more independent. He had no wife, lived apart from the rest in the seas, not in Valinor, and only turned up for very important councils with the rest of the Valar. He is also said to be the Valar who never forsook the children of Ilúvatar, elves and men, even when all the other Valar did. We see him several times in the pages of the Silmarillion, intervening to help out in Middle-earth when the rest of the Valar were refusing to engage. Next, we have Aule, the smith. He, with Manwë and Ulmo, did a lot of the heavy lifting when Arda was first fashioned. He was in charge of forging lands and mountains, rocks and gems. Being a great craftsman, many learned under him. Sauron, then a Maia called Mairon, was his, hence his skills forging rings, and Feanor, that mightiest of elves, also learned under him. He went on to make the Silmarils. Aule also made a whole race of beings, the dwarves, hence their love of crafting, smithing, and mining. Aule's wife was Yavanna, who, as we've already noted, was responsible for growing things. All that which grew and sprouted and gave life in Arda was of her hand and hard work. It was her who made the two trees, who illuminated and nourished the lands after the lamps had been destroyed, and it was in response to her pleading that Eru brought into being the Ents to protect the trees and growing things. Then we have Arome, the huntsman. As his name would suggest, he spent a lot of his time hunting monsters and fell beasts. He roamed further than most of the Valar, and thus it was he who discovered the elves when they first awoke and alerted the rest of the Valar. Mandos, the judge of the dead, rules over the Halls of the Dead, or the Halls of Mandos, as they are generally known. He is also the so-called Doomsman of the Valar, pronouncing judgments at the command of Manwë. He is said to remember more of what was and is to come than the other Valar. Famously in the Silmarillion, the Doom of Mandos was a curse placed on the Noldor for their rebellion. Finally, of the eight greatest Valar, we have Nienna, the Lady of Mercy. Her main realm is that of grief and sorrow, which sounds a bit of a downer, and she certainly plays her part by forever mourning the damage evil has done in the world and spending a lot of her time in the Halls of Waiting, where dead souls go to await their fate. But through the grief is learned mercy and courage. Gandalf, as Alorin the Maia, learned a lot from her. So those are the eight most powerful Valar. Manwë, Varda, Ulmo, Aule, Yavanna, Arome, Mandos, and Nienna. The other six are Lórien, the Lord of Visions and Dreams, and his wife Este, who had the power to heal all. Tulkas, the mighty warrior who laughed a lot. He was the last of the Valar to arrive, and his arrival tipped the balance in the first round of struggles against Melkor. And his wife Nessa, who was swifter than a deer and loved to dance. Vaere, the weaver, wife of Mandos and responsible for weaving the story of the world, and finally Vanna, the wife of Arome, associated with youth and flowers and beauty. So, 14 Valar, 7 male and 7 female. But of course, we are missing one, Melkor, who became known as Morgoth. He is technically not counted as one of the Valar, though he was one of the Ainur at the beginning of the story and did descend to Arda with the rest. We'll cover his full rebellion another time. Suffice to say that he is the antagonist through much of the Silmarillion, sowing discord among the Song of the Ainur, opposing the Valar again and again in Arda, destroying their works and seeking to rule himself. He was the most powerful of the Ainur, even more so than Manwë, and was granted insight into every aspect of Ilúvatar's mind, not just one aspect, as with most of the Valar. But He was rebellious and proud and drew many of the Ainur to his side. His defeat at the end of the First Age was no small thing. Perhaps the final thing to note with the Valar is how they ruled. For it is noticeable that the very hands-on approach they had to start with, moulding and shaping the world and engaging directly with the children of Iluvatar, slowly faded over time. Aman, the western continent of Middle-earth, became a place just for the Valar, Maiar, and some of the firstborn of the children of Iluvatar, the elves. Humans were explicitly banned, as were other, probably less desirable, races. The Undying Lands were even removed from physical ardour to increase the distance. Direct interactions with Middle-earth increasingly came through emissaries. The Eagles keeping watch for Manwë, the Istari coming in secret to help the Free Peoples against Sauron, and so on. And as the Fourth Age began after the events of the Lord of the Rings, the Valar became still more distant. Their emissaries to Middle-earth died, disappeared, or returned to Valinor, like Gandalf. Their creations and beloved ones that stayed, like the dwarves and elves, faded from history. The ships sailing west stopped. Did the Valar turn their back on Middle-earth? It's a point long discussed among Tolkien scholars, and I gave my take in another video if you're interested. But there can be no doubt that the Valar are not as present as they once were. They will, we are told, grow weary before the end. Perhaps Ulmo, who never abandoned the children of Iluvatar, still watches on from the waters, but with the dominion of man comes the silence of the Valar. If you'd like to see more Lord of the Rings videos, please click on the link on the left of your screen. Or if you'd like to support the channel, thank you. There's a link to my Patreon page on the right of your screen. That's all for this time. Thanks for watching. I'll see you again soon.